All right. Hope everybody had a wonderful Pesach, wonderful holiday. I apologize, my voice is a little bit sore tonight.
Sorry, we have to record the class.
Yeah. I turned the thing on to record it, so we could send out for anybody who's not able to be here. Hi, Mayor, welcome. This is in the front.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I don't know, I'm saying there's a source sheet. We're quite lucky. So tonight we're going to talk about Tamar. So there are three different Tamars mentioned in the Torah. So I had to pick one out of three to talk about. Couldn't do all three. I picked one that was the most information on. And then I was looking, when I set the people that we're going to learn about this year, we made the dates for the calendar, so it was completely random. And I had no idea. I picked it April 10th. We talk about Tamar. And then, everyone knows that there's a thing called the Daf Yomi. The Daf Yomi is where you learn one page of the Talmud every single day. And if you learn one page a day, so you complete the entire cycle of going through it one time in 7.5 years. So there are 2,711 pages of the Daf Yomi. So we had a 1 in 2,711 chance that today's Daf will be talking about Tamar. Oh, wow! God is smiling on us right now, because today's Daf Yomi talks about Tamar. I would have put it on the source sheet if I would have realized it in time, but the source is already made up, and I got today's Daf Yomi. I just want to read to you. It's a perfect intro for discussing who we're going to be learning about tonight. So it talks about some people, you can do a mitzvah for not pure reasons, or you can do a mitzvah for pure reasons. But it says you can do an aveira, you can do a sin, something that looks wrong, but for pure reasons. And the Gemara has a discussion, which is better? To do a mitzvah for unpure reasons, shelo lishma, or to do an aveira, a sin, with pure intentions. So the Gemara quotes Tamar. And it says, Tamar, zonsa, she did an act of inappropriate relationships. However, yotze mimeno malachim unavim. But kings and prophets came from her as a result of her action. Meaning that she did something that at first glance, and we'll go through the sources right now, seems to be very inappropriate, extremely inappropriate. We would never do such a thing. But Tamar does it, and the Gemara actually praises her for her actions. So that's today's Daf Yomi. It's a perfect time, because that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. So we'll jump right into the sources. The story of Tamar is in Bereishis. The background behind it is that, remember, Yosef had dreams, and his brothers did not like his dreams, with them bowing down to him, and they didn't like the fact that his father favored him, and he gave an amazing technicolor dream coat, so they decided they're going to get rid of him. So Yosef is sold, and he's sent down to Egypt. And then, before we resume the story of Yosef, in the middle of it comes the story of Yehuda and Tamar. So the brothers were upset with Yehuda because he was the leader, and he didn't advise them not to sell Yosef. They said, look, if you would have told us not to do it, we would have listened to you, but you didn't do it. So now we see how upset our fathers, it's all your fault. So Yehuda's basically ostracized. He's sent away from his brothers, they don't want to have anything to do with him. So I'm going to pick it up, and we'll get a little more background also before we start reading the verses. He has a business partner, and he marries a woman. We don't know exactly who her name is, but she has sons. So he has a son named Er, a son named Onan, and they marry this girl named Tamar. And her two husbands die. Tamar's first husband, Er, dies. Tamar's second husband, his other son, Onan, dies. And now they'll start with verse number 11. And I apologize, the voice is not so strong. Then Yehuda said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. Okay, my first son is dead. My second son is dead. I got number three, lest he die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. So Rashi points out that he really wasn't intending. Rashi in the box, he dismissed her with a lame excuse. He did not intend for her to really marry Shelah. So that's going to be part of the background, understanding why she did what she did. Okay, the verse continues. Many days passed, and Shua's daughter, Yehuda's wife, died, and now Yehuda was consoled. He went up to watch over his sheep shears, and he and Chira, that was his businessman, went to Timnah. And it was told to Tamar, saying, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garb. We'll talk about clothing later on. But she takes off, there was special clothing that she was wearing to son. I think they have in Italian. The Italians use it, right? What's it called? Like Italian.
Like a mantella or something?
They wear something. No, they wear like a, it's like all black or something. Yeah. Right? You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So there's certain clothing. So you see in the ancient Middle East that they had the same thing. There was a certain type of clothing that widows would wear, covered her head with a veil and covered her face, and she sat down at the crossroads that were on the way to Timnah, for she saw that she had grown up, but she was not given to him for a wife. So we can infer, had Yehuda really given his third son to Tamar, she never would have done what she's about to do. But she sees she was promised him, and it's not happening. She sees he's grown up; he could be a father now, but he's not being given over in marriage. So she says, "I have to take things into my own hand." So I pause now and ask you, why was Tamar doing this? Why is Tamar setting herself at this point now to have a relationship with Yehuda? What was motivating her? There had to be some reason why. It says that she wasn't given the son she was as the husband she's supposed to have, so she was going to have relations with him. So there is a concept in the Torah called Yibum. I think in English they generally leave right marriage. Have you heard of the word of Yibum? Do you know what this is? It's the Torah says in the end of Devarim that, let's say a couple is married and the husband dies without any children. So there's a mitzvah for the dead husband's brother to marry the wife. This is called Yibum, right? So, now, he has two choices. He could actually marry the woman. It's called Yibum. There's a different ceremony where takes off a shoe and she spits in it, and that basically releases the bond that was between the widow and her brother-in-law. So nowadays, based upon in the Middle Ages already, we stopped doing the Yibum. At least Ashkenazic Jewry don't do this anymore, because Rashi's rabbi, the Rabbeinu Gershom, put a ban upon this, an excommunication, and said, we don't do this anymore. We don't have more than one wife. So therefore, that option of doing the Yibum is no longer, of marrying her is no longer there. So therefore, we do the Chalitza. It's an elaborate ceremony. I actually saw what the Chalitza shoe looks like. The straps around are the same type of straps like tefillin, like the black mitzvos that you wrap. So it's a type of shoe that looks like that. It doesn't come up so often, just because of the reality of it, but there have been times when unfortunately it had to be done. On a sad note, it was done after 9/11. There were attacks where young couples, and they didn't have any children yet, and then there was a mitzvah for the brother to marry the widow. So obviously they don't do that anymore, so they did it. Sephardim do this. It's a side point. Svardim, I have a friend who's from Yemenite, Taimani, and he tells me his grandfather has two bubbies. He's got two saftas, he's got two grandmas, because in the Svardic circles, again, the Ashkenazic tradition is not to marry more than one wife, but the Svardim do. I think the Mormons also, right? Mormons also have?
Not anymore.
Not anymore? Utah, guys, I saw an article, some guy's like 80 wives. I don't know. In Halakha, how many wives is a king, how many wives is a king allowed to have?
1,000?
Oh, no, that's too many. Someone got in trouble for that. You have 18. That's it. No more than 18. 19 wives is too many. But 18 you're okay with. I'm just telling you, call it like you see it. Yeah. So here, watch what's happening now. Really, this idea of the brother marrying the widow, that was only after the Torah was given. Before the Torah was given, which is our story with Yehuda and Tamar, before the Torah was given, any male relative could release her of the bond. So Tamar understands that she's not going to marry Shela, she's not going to marry him, so she might as well have relations with Yehuda that would accomplish the same thing. She's very wise in her actions with that. And we'll read a few more things and we'll get to the things. Verse 15, Yehuda saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she covered her face. So Rashi explains, what does that mean? Because she covered her face, he couldn't see her and recognize her. Our sage's midrashic interpretation is because she covered her face when she stayed in her father's-in-law house and she was modest, therefore he didn't suspect her. Meaning, not that her face was covered now, that line that her face was covered, he recognized it, was going back to all the years she was in his house. She's very modest. So he didn't recognize this person now as the same modest one who was there all along. So he turned aside toward her, toward the road. And that's the way the text reads. The midrashim explained that he was pushed. I don't know how to, he was pushed in that direction. He was not going to walk towards the direction where Tamar was. The Medrash says that he was pushed in that direction. And he said, get ready now, I'll come to you, for he didn't know she was his daughter-in-law, and she said, "What will you give me that you should come to me?" And he said, "I'll send you a kid from the herd." And she said, "Only if you give me a pledge until you send it," meaning he didn't have payment, so he has to leave collateral. He said, "What's the pledge I should give you?" She said, "Your signet, your cloak, and the staff that's in your hand." So he gave them to her, he came to her, and she conceived his likeness. So do you know what a signet is? It's like a ring. In those days, it was a necklace that was worn around the thing. Actually, one of my Bible professors in Yeshiva University brought in one in class one day and showed it. It was so cool. You had like a wax, and then you would put the signet in, and that was your driver's license. It was your unique identifier. No one else had it. So if you had that driver's license, if you had that signet, that was your identification. That's who you were. No one else could fake it. Everyone has their own unique one. So he's giving over his driver's license, he's giving her his social security number, he's giving her all these things. That's the pledge. You better be sure he's coming back to get that. She's smart. She's saying, "I want something. I'm making sure that you're not going to just disappear. I'm going to get the payment." Now, again, just to intellect here, I didn't put all the sources on it, but the Rambam says something interesting. The Rambam, Maimonides, who we've quoted many times over the years in these classes, Maimonides writes that, again, we're dealing with before the Torah was given. And to our modern sensibilities, to pay a woman for relations seems disgusting. It was not prohibited back then. If they were both consenting, it can't be done against either one of them. If both the man and woman consented and paid for services, that was, technically speaking, nothing wrong with it. Again, it's not a modern idea, but back then it was a service, and technically it wasn't. So he points out, the Rambam writes how remarkable Yehuda was in the sense that he goes and makes sure to pay about that. We'll go through a few more of the verses. I'm going to skip a little bit. He tries to find her, he can't find her, right? Verse 22, so he, meaning the one that Yehuda sent to go get back his items with he had the sheep, "I didn't find her in the people places. No harlot was here. So you said, let her take them for herself. She can keep it then, lest we become a laughing stock. Behold, I sent this, but we didn't find her." Rashi says, "A laughing stock. If we seek her further, the matter will become known, will be a disgrace. What more am I required you to keep my word?" So at this point, the Rambam says, you see something here. Even though technically speaking, there wasn't anything wrong with what he did, but there's certain things that aren't supposed to be discreet and to be private about that. So that's why Yehuda said, "I'm not going to go and start asking and doing a whole investigation. It happened. It was okay, but it's not necessarily proper to speak about things in public." Nowadays, every sort of scandal, they take the most inappropriate things, they blast them all across the news, the media, and the internet. But you see, says the Rambam, that there's certain things that even though they're okay, they're not necessarily meant to be discussed in a public sphere. So that's how he explains this story. Okay, and then within one verse, we jump 3 months. It came after 3 months, it was told to Yehuda saying, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she's pregnant from harlotry." So Yehuda said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." So why would it take 3 months? That's when it starts to show, right? That's usually when, usually not always, that's usually when people start to tell. You know, guess what? We're expecting. You can't really hide it anymore. So at 3 months, she couldn't hide it anymore. And he says, okay, she has to be burned. Why? Why does Tamar have to be burned? So Rashi explains, because she was the daughter of a Kohen. It goes through the whole her lineage, and therefore that's the punishment for a bas Kohen, a daughter of a Kohen who does this action. The punishment is straight as being burned. Now,
even if she's not married?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, correct. She was taken out, sent to her father saying, now watch this, "From the man to whom these belong, I'm pregnant." She said, like, "I care not, please recognize whose signet ring, cloak, and staff are these." So we see the heroism of Tamar. She doesn't say what? It's you. You're condemning that. But by the way, it's you. She asks him to please recognize. What's the inference? What if Yehuda would not say that, by the way, oh yeah, that's me?
She would have been burned.
She would have been burned. So the Talmud brings in several different places. The Gemara's learn out. From here you see that it's better to be burned than to embarrass somebody. Oh, what do you mean? Look what Tamar's actions was. She didn't say, by the way, it was you. How embarrassing. Yehuda's in front of all of his friends and his family. He's a powerful man. It's a scandal. No, she doesn't say anything. It's now the ball is in his court. If he's going to recognize, and he can't because he knows who signed it, he knows everything, he understands, he forgot. But now the question is up to Yehuda.
What exactly is the scandal, then?
What did he do wrong? What do you think?
I think it's just slightly embarrassing that you slept with your daughter-in-law.
Okay.
And so that you then made a whole big show of bringing her out and saying to her.
Could be that's it. Could be exactly it. It's the embarrassment they had relations with her. And what were we going to add?
If her father was so important and she needs to be burned because of her father's status, why didn't her father intercede to begin with?
Could be he's not around. Could be he's not around. It's not her direct father.
She was sent home.
She was not. It's not. Shame was lived many, many generations before. Shame was one of the sons of Noach, so she was a direct descendant from him. But we're talking 10+ generations later.
But her own father.
Her own father probably is not in the picture. There's a few personalities we don't know. We don't know who Yehuda's wife was. I asked around when I was a member years ago. I was trying to find out. No one could tell me. No one knows who the name of his wife is. Yehuda's wife. There's certain people just they're not present in the story. It's basically isolated. You have Yehuda and you have Tamar. And you have his sons, right? Er, Onan, and Shelah, but they don't talk at all. We have their actions recorded for us, but there's very little. The dialogue is Yehuda and Tamar. So it's almost as if, I imagine I'm not a director of a play, but they're like the spotlight's on them, and all the other characters almost like pushed to the side. We're focusing just on this interaction between Yehuda and Tamar. Years ago, before I was married, I used to eat a lot of Shabbos meals by Rabbi Willig from Yeshiva University. So he had a friend who's one of his sons is a friend of mine, so I used to go there a lot for Shabbos. And I remember we were sitting at the Shabbos table, going back to the 90s. And I don't recall entirely if he told the story or actually pulled out the letter. But he had a letter that at that time was President Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton wrote a letter to Rabbi Menachem Ganak, who is the head of the OU. Do you know who he is? Rabbi Ganak?
I was just looking that he's speaking somewhere.
Oh, he's a great speaker. So Rabbi Ganak was like Clinton's rabbi. Because the OU has a lot to do with like legal issues and kashrus and shechita, they had a lot of interactions in the political realms, they had to do a lot of advocacy, so he knew him. And they called him Clinton's rabbi, and he used to talk to him. Stories. I think Bill Clinton like knew the Bible very well. Knows the Bible, I should speak in present tense, he knows the Bible very well. And one of the ideas that Rabbi Ganak was sharing with President Clinton was this story. And the reaction that Yehuda had that a leader is not a flaw. It's actually a merit when a leader can stand up and say, "I made a mistake." And Clinton was very impressed with. He was saying over from Rabbi Soloveitchik this idea that that's a mark of a leader. So turn to the next page for a second, and we'll see Yehuda's reaction. Yehuda recognized them. Now he could have said that he could have taken the easy way out. We just saw if Yehuda didn't say anything, that's it. Tamar's gone. She's right, Sad Kamimani, it's from me. Because I didn't give her my son Shelah, and he no longer continued to be intimate with her. So Yehuda at this point, just imagine the scene. Everybody's watching. It's the most embarrassing thing in the world, and he has to admit, I was wrong. I was the one who slept with my daughter-in-law. I was the one who falsely accused her. I'm the one who did all these things. And what? I didn't give her Shayla. I didn't marry her or give her my son. Yeah.
So basically, the intention was for her to get burned, but in the end, he really got burned.
That's right.
The embarrassment. So it was a flip.
Also, you're correct. The irony is not lost on that.
Right. And also, Tamar was very small because she used those three things that she took from him as an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
She really had great insight.
We see she was motivated with Shem Shemayim. And we'll come back to at the end what the symbolism of those three objects are. They weren't just, it just happened to be, my car keys, my wallet, my iPhone. There was actually a tremendous depth that the rabbis saw as to why those three items. Okay, so the story gives a little bit more. She gave birth and there were twins, right? And then one of the twins is Peretz. Peretz is going to become the great, 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 great grandfather of David HaMelech, of kingship. The kingdom comes from Yehuda. And that's the idea, those are our leaders. And the idea of Yehuda being there as the leader, which Tamar brings out. Tamar in her, as you said, a very bright woman in her strategy is able to elicit that type of response and to bring out Yehuda who will become the king. And we rise from the challenges we have in life. And Tamar puts him in a very difficult situation. Not that he didn't deserve it, I'm not saying that, but she forces his hand, so to speak. And he had two options. He could have taken the easy, cowardly way out. But I want to suggest there's much more going on with this whole story, what Tamar is doing, and we'll go through that. So we began by pointing out that really this story seems to be a little bit out of place, right? Because basically the last third of the book of Genesis is talking about Yosef. Yosef, when he's a young man, when he's 17, put the story of Yehuda and Tamar on the side for a second, we'll come back to it. Then it talks about when he was sold. Remember Yosef was sold? He goes to the house of Potiphar, and he's rising up in status there, and there's a scandal with Yosef and Potiphar's wife. He gets thrown in jail, and in jail are the butler and the baker and the wine steward, and he hears their dreams, he interprets the dreams, and then Paro has dreams, and then Yosef is called to do the dreams, and he rises up, he has this meteor. He's up, he's down, he's doing all the things. So what in the world do we have to insert this story of Yehuda and Tamar? It doesn't make sense. So some biblical scholars, not from religious circles, will suggest all sorts of crazy ideas that there was multiple authors and this, but we don't believe in that stuff. So I want to try to explain what the depth is behind why these stories are right there. So we have almost like a commercial break. You know, they always try to put, in the television show, they always try to have like a moment of suspense, and then like, you know, then comes your commercial to buy like Snickers or buy like some auto insurance or something, right? So...
Also in the elementary school, like they skip.
Oh yeah, they skip this. This is not. This is for sure.
What about high school? Do they?
We skip a lot in high school too. But
the boys learn. Yeah, they skipped over them.
Yeah. Especially the co-ed classroom. Yeah. But it's not. It's not avoided. It's talked about. But you have to know. You have to know which class you can do it with, which class you can't do it with, right?
Parsha Shavua, they definitely skip over, right?
Yeah. But we're not going to skip it tonight. We're trying to... So in the meantime, I want to explain why this is. So if you look at the idea, there's really a contrast that's being set up. The two sons of Yehuda and Yosef, we don't know yet who's going to be the next real leader of the Jewish people. So the Torah is putting and contrasting them and making very striking parallels between the story of Yosef and the story of Yehuda, to see who is going to, quote-unquote, win. So let's turn to the next page for a second. And I'm grateful to one of the head of Tanakh, of Chumash, is Mrs. Yael Goldfisher. So she put together a list of similarities between the stories of Yosef and the story of Yehuda. So the first thing, as I said, we come back that there's a lot of talk about clothing, right? So in the story that we had, which you read on the left-hand side, was about Tamar taking off the widow's garb, right? Covering her face, right? And it was the whole clothing issue, removing the clothing, putting on new clothing. So we see the same thing with Yosef in two different locations. One of them, we know that he gets that called the Kisonas Pasin, right? Broadway got it correct, the amazing Technicolor dream coat. It was a colorful garment. Now, Kisonas Pasin is a word that only appears one other place in the Torah. It's in Navi, in Shmuel. There's a woman whose name is Tamar. Interesting about her, Tamar. She wears Kisonas Pasim, and it's described over there as a garment that princesses wore. It was a sign of royalty. So by Yosef getting this fantastic multicolored coat from his father, it's not only just, oh, by the way, I really like you, I'm going to give you an extra article of clothing that none of your other brothers get. It's almost as if he's designating him to be the leader. I don't know about you. Yeah. Is anyone here an only child? No? I'm not an only child. If my older sister got a special coat saying, Mom and Dad picked me, you understand why there's tension. You understand there's a lot. There's such a human drama that's happening in these stories. Very little do we hear of Hashem's direct involvement. In the beginning of Chumash, when you have Abraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov, Hashem is all the time appearing to them and telling them. Here there's much more interpersonal drama and conflict happening. Another place we find the coat or clothing is when Yosef is alone with the wife of his master, and she concocts this whole scandal, and she says, she grabs him by his clothing and says, lie with me. But he left the garment in her hand, and he runs outside. So she's holding on to his garment. She obviously changes the story and says, look, he came to me and I fought him off, and I'm holding on to his clothing to prove it. But that's not what really happened. But the idea of clothing, both in the story of Yehuda and the story of Yosef, is very often. Both are separated from the family. Yehuda, as we said, was ostracized. The brothers didn't want to be around him because they saw how much pain their father was in after they sold him and said, you were the leader. You would have told us not to do it. We would have avoided him. And Yosef obviously is sold away. There's the death of a child. Now Yosef is not really dead, but they tell his father he's dead. Yehuda, two of his sons died from after Tamar. There's a seduction story, both with Yehuda and Tamar, and then Yosef and the wife of Potiphar. There's a lot of disguises happening. Tamar disguises himself. Yosef disguises himself. The brothers don't recognize him. He was this little kid. He was a 17-year-old the last time they saw him. And now it's so many years later, he's got a full beard, and his name has changed. He's Tzafnas Paneach. He's the vice president of Egypt. He's a very powerful person. There's lies. Yehuda lied to Tamar about giving her son Shelah. The brothers lied to Yaakov about what happened to Yosef. They're both on death row in each story. Tamar, again, just a lot of similarities. Tamar was sentenced to be death, and the Sarah Ophim, the baker, was sentenced to be dead. It was because of what he did with Paro, that he wasn't careful about preparing the food before it got to him. And you also have a very protective father for the youngest son, right? Interesting connection. Yehuda's protective and won't give over his youngest son, Shelah, and Yaakov is very protective for Binyamin because that was the one who they wanted to bring down to Egypt. So the question is why? Why are there all these similarities? Again, the clothing, the seduction, and the lying. So really, if the Torah is doing this, we have to understand there's something the Torah wants us to realize, that these two things are very intimately connected. There's strong connections between the parallel stories that we're getting side by side, and it's not an interruption, but really it's a contrast on purpose between the story with Yehuda and Tamar and in the larger picture of what's going on over here. So Yehuda wins. Yehuda wins. Kingship comes from Yehuda. It doesn't come from Yosef. We have to figure out why. What did Yehuda do? So if I'd ask you, pause before we go through the rest of the sources, what would you say? Why does Yehuda win?
I always thought because he took responsibility.
Took responsibility.
Which was a flip from when Yosef got sold. So he grew up.
He grew up. You see a character development happening, right? In the beginning, does he take any responsibility for his actions?
For Yosef?
No, it's always blaming others. He's blaming. He sends his associate to go bring the sheep to this woman. He doesn't take it himself. But by the very end, when the words are in Hebrew, tzadka mimeni, when he realizes that she's right. And many times you have like an epiphany. We have these moments where just everything we thought up until now, a certain point, suddenly is not the way we thought it was. And Yehuda does it, and he grows from that. And that's a powerful message as a leader. We're not born perfect. It's a process, right? So if Hirsch explains a little bit that maybe that's because of the mothers, that that Leah, who was Yehuda's mother, always had to work harder for everything. She was the life who we talked about was switched, right? Wasn't supposed to be married to Yaakov in the first place. Had a much more of a difficult thing. Each one of her sons is named for this struggle. Yehuda is the fourth son. Right, so because she realized she got more than she was supposed to, she felt entitled to. On the next page, it says everything came so easy to Yosef. Right, he finds favor, people like him, gets a special chain, something that you can't really put your finger on. But the key difference is this seduction story. At the end of the day, who gave in? Yehuda gave in. So you would have thought, well, one second, if he gives in, how does he get to be the king? Yosef's the hero. The little kid Yosef is the one who stands up for it, right? So the difference is, no, a leader doesn't mean you're perfect. A leader means you make mistakes, but you grow from them. So if you look here, you have a little bit of a development, right? He's blaming others, right? Doesn't think his own kids did anything wrong. It must be Tamar's fault. Even after he goes to the prostitute, he has the friend do it, and he hears Tamar's pregnant. He says, quickly, okay, get her out of here. But I want to show with you that real leadership needs to have a skeleton in the closet. The Gemara tells us why Shaul, different, wasn't made king because he was perfect. He didn't have any blemishes. So the reason a leader has to have some sort of skeleton keeps them humble. Remember where you came from. Because if that person will ever get haughty, they can look and say, you have a Kupushel Shratzim, you have a history. You got some skeletons in your closet. And the Radak says this beautiful idea. I'll read it to you on the source sheet. V'chol ha-devarim ha'ele ha'yos zera Yehuda. Bob said, I read that wrong. Boz aderech yos David mirus ha-moavi v'shlomi ba-sheva. All of the kingships come from questionable relationships. V'chol ha-yasibam e'es Hashem. This is all because Hashem wanted to happen this way. Shelo yizga umalche Yehuda al Yisrael. So the Jewish kings should not become haughty. Yizku tzur chatzavu mimenu. Remember where they came from. V'yushfali ruach. They'll be humble. V'nihu hamalchus be'anova. They'll be very low on themselves. V'tam levam. They have a sincere heart. So a Jewish leader has to have mistakes. I guess in politics, if they find out like what you did in college, they can like ruin your presidential campaign. Right? There's, I know Rabbi Berzin once told a story of a Republican, I forget the name, but he says a Republican was about to win the Republican nomination, and the night beforehand, one of his college buddies went to like someone high up in the party and told him what he used to do in college, and he lost the Republican nomination because of his college sordid history. But we look at it a little differently. We're not encouraging people to do anything wrong, but that's almost like a necessary requirement to be a true Jewish leader. The Gemara tells a story of four people who never did anything wrong. Gemara Bava Basra. Here, I'll read the English. The sages taught in the Braisa, there were four people who died only because of the counsel of the snake, meaning from Garden of Eden. In the wake of all humanity became mortal, but not on account of any personal sin. So the four people are Binyamin, the son of Yaakov, Amram, the father of Moshe, Yishai, the father of David, and Chilav, the son of David. So let me ask you a question. Do we hear much about these people? Binyamin, Amram, Yishai, or Chilav?
Definitely not Chilav.
We don't hear much about any of these guys. They were perfect, they never sinned. But the difference is, if you want to make a change in the world, you have to get your feet wet. You have to get down in the dirt. People, Avram Avinu is not on this list. Yitzchak is not. Yaakov is not on the list. They all did sins. That's what it means to be human. You make mistakes. But that's part of life. You know, a ship is safe when it's in the harbor. But that's not what you have a ship for. A ship is designed to go out and to sail, to do things, to accomplish. We all have certain comfort zones that we feel we're safe in. But if we don't leave that comfort zone, we're not going to be able to accomplish anything. And part of being a leader like Yehuda is, which Tamar helped bring about through the events, is to realize that we can make mistakes. And as President Clinton very much liked the idea from Soloveitchik, it's okay when a leader makes mistakes, but you have to be able to admit that. The worst thing is when you make mistakes and you don't admit it. You can't talk to the person, you're wrong. They say, no, I'm right, they're stubborn. Okay, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about having a healthy courage to try, but to understand that even when we don't succeed, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, there's everything right. We're supposed to try to continue to grow. Now, I want just to touch upon one final aspect of the story with Yehuda and Tamar. On the Ramban writes that all of the stories we have are to give over very esoteric ideas. So this connection between Yehuda and Tamar is symbolic on many levels. The idea of Yehuda, the name Yehuda itself is spelled Yud, He, Vav, Dalet, He. Yehuda. Yud, He, Vav, Dalet, He. It's the only one of the names of the tribes that has God's four-letter name in there. Right? It has Yud, Ke, Vav, Ke. Just has an extra Dalet in there as well, but it's the only one, right? Reuven, Shimon, right? Levi, whatever. Fill in all the names. None of them else have it except Yehuda. Yehuda is representative in a symbolic way of Hashem, right? Just like Hashem is the Melech, is the king, so too Yehuda is the king in this world. Tamar is representative of the Jewish people. So the relationship between Yehuda and Tamar is, on a certain spiritual, mystical level, the Sfarim discuss, a metaphor for the relationship between God and the Jewish people. You with me on that? Follow? Any questions? Huh? You look like I'm getting like a look.
But what is the metaphor?
Oh, so let's work it out. What does Yehuda say? Let's go back to the verse 24. It came now. Yehuda and Tamar were together, right? When does a Jew feel closest to Hashem? What time of the year do you feel the closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Now it came after nearly 3 months. So 3 months later, after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, is Hanukkah. Right? And it was told to Yehuda, meaning there's an accusation made to Hashem, saying, your daughter-in-law Tamar has been unfaithful. the Jewish people were so close to you 3 months ago, but now they become unfaithful. All the promises they made in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and how they're going to improve, and how much they're going to do better, and how much they're going to try to do more acts of kindness, and mitzvahs, and learning, and tzedakah, and whatever it was the person promised they were going to do for the upcoming year. They've been unfaithful, Hashem. This is the accusation that's made. Again, just working out the metaphor. The accusation that's made against Tamar in this world is the accusation that's made against the Jewish people. Tamar represents the Jewish people. So, and not only that, not only have they been unfaithful, Zonza, she became pregnant. It's become part of who she is. These foreign ideas and these commitments, these temptations and everything that the Jewish people got involved in. It's not about if they fooled around a little bit. They became pregnant from it. The Jewish people have incorporated part of their psyche and their worldview. The Jewish people have not been faithful to you, Hashem. Yehuda equals Hashem. So what happens? Bring her out and burn her. Hashem says, okay, you're right. I'm looking, and I have a prosecution against my beloved Jewish people. And she was taken out and said to her father, from the man to these belong, I'm pregnant. Recognize the signet ring, the cloak, and the staff. So Tamar, the Jewish people answer back, it's true. The accusation is true, but I want you to look and see who I'm really pregnant from. These three items, the ring, the cloak, and the staff, if we were doing the Hebrew, they correspond to the three different parts of the Hanukkah menorah. The base, the stand, the oil, and the wick. It's 3 months later now. It's after Rosh Hashanah says, Hanukkah, you're right, but look who I became pregnant from. Look who I'm intrinsically connected to. Even when a Jew does things that at surface level look to be so far and so distant from Hashem, the Jew, in essence and nature, cannot be separated from Hashem. So this is an idea that Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson has. I'll just show you in the last page. You see where it says, who is the traitor? See on the second last page? Yehuda immediately recognized the article and said, she's right, it's for me she conceived. She did it because I didn't give her my son, Shelah. God immediately recognized that indeed his people never left him. True, the Jew does fall prey at times to dominating external forces of materialistic and immoral world. Yet this enslavement is skin deep. Probe the layers of his or her soul and you'll discover an infinite wellspring of spirituality and love. If the Jew has in fact gone astray here and there, it's my fault, God says, not his, because I didn't give Tamar is the Jewish people, my son Shelah. Shelah is the biblical term used to describe Mashiach. I didn't give the Jewish people Shelah, I didn't give Mashiach yet. I haven't brought redemption into the world. God says that for two millennia I've kept the Jewish nation in dark and horrific exile, where they've been subjected to horrendous pain and savage suffering. Blood, tears, and death have been their tragic fate for 20 centuries as they prayed each day and every moment for world redemption. But redemption has not come. How can I expect the Jew never commit a sin? How can I expect the Jew will never try to cast his luck with a materialistic world about him, around him or her that seems to be so appealing? Why held back for so long the light of Mashiach? It is I, God, who's guilty of treason, God says, not the Jew. Tamar is an innocent, beautiful palm tree which still has only one heart to its Father in heaven. So the idea of Tamar, even as a physical person, on a deeper Kabbalistic imagery, is that Tamar represents the Jewish people. And the idea when Yehuda agrees to Tamar, it's a symbolic of Hashem agreeing to the Jewish people, saying that yes, if you're right, I didn't give you Shelah, I haven't you sent Mashiach. So I think a lot of important lessons to learn from it. Our ultimate prayers, our tefillah is that we should be privileged to see the time when Shelah comes to Tamar, when Mashiach comes to the Jewish people. B'mehra b'yameinu. Thank you everyone for coming, and I do apologize for the little hoarseness in the voice.